obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name's Hilda. I am an alcoholic. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really want to thank Shirali and the committee for asking me for Thursday night. I love Thursday night, because truly I believe Thursday night are the people who love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I really believe that's true, because if you're working, you took the time off work, right? You made the trek out here. If you're retired and living here, well, you didn't have anywhere else to be anyway, But I love Thursday night. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like being around people who love Alcoholics Anonymous. There's something that is infectious about that, you know, and I love the desert. I know a lot of people in this room tonight because we come out to the desert a lot. And, I took the day off work as well, and we left early and we're out here early. But it's sort of, I don't know, there's some sort of vortex as you go by the outlets in Morongo that pulls the car, you know. You can't quite get by without going in, you know, so... But I do love being here, and I'm not sure who did the gift basket, but it's fantastic. I've never seen a basket like it. We were delighted, really nice. But I am glad to be here, and I do love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's nice to see so many friends. And let's see. My sobriety date is the 20th of July, 1993. It's not my first, but I truly hope it is my last. I was born in London, and many of you know I grew up in a pub. No, I really did. My grandparents owned the pub, and I'm an only child and an only grandchild, and only children like myself are very good at entertaining ourselves. That's what we do. And, you know, for me, my playground was the cellar, and I loved it. You know, I loved it. Even driving out here today, we went by the Miller Brewery off the 210, and, you know, the temptation is to put the windows down for the ambiance. You know, it's, I love it, you know. That's what I grew up with, that smell of hops, and, you know, and my the bottles were my playthings. You know, long before I ever had a drink, I loved alcohol. I loved the look of it and the fancy bottles and the labels, and I just thought it was fantastic. And, you know, I used to line the whiskey bottles up on one side and the vodka bottles up on the other, and I'd have the whiskey bottles chatting to the vodka bottles, and they'd be chatting to me, and I'd be chatting to them. And, you know, whiskey was the bad guys, and vodka was the good guys. And, you know, the only kind of sad part about that is it was still happening in my 20s, you know. But I loved it. And, you know, my granddad's pub, my bedroom window looked straight down into the long bar. There was like a little alleyway between the kitchen and the long bar, and my bedroom was above the kitchen, and it looked straight down into it. And the long bar was where life happened. You know, they had discos and pool tournaments and dart tournaments, and fights would break out, and the police would come, and it would be chaos. And I'd be watching from my bedroom window thinking it was better than telly. You know, I loved it. And they had this thing called lock-in in London during that time. And after hours, the publicans like my granddad would lock all the doors, and the regulars got to stay. And they would turn the lights down, and they would turn the jukebox down, and the regulars could drink until my granddad went to bed. And I would watch them from my bedroom window, and it just looked magic. You know, the neon lights would be glowing through the optics of the bottles hanging up, and I just loved it. And, you know, one night I snuck down, and I popped my head into the bar, and my granddad flagged me in, and he gave me a baby sham. And, you know, baby shams at the time came in a little bottle, and they had a cartoon deer as the logo that was sort of leaping, you know. And he put it in a little glass, and I was a little person, and it was a little bottle. And I didn't know how old I was, but my pajamas still had feet in them, you know. But, you know, I don't believe that's why I'm an alcoholic, and to this day I can't tell you if I like the taste or I got tipsy or anything. I really don't know. I just know that I felt part of that night, you know, and I probably spent the rest of my drinking trying to get that night back, you know. And for me, alcohol worked for a very long time. You know, I was in boarding school Monday to Friday, and I would go home on the weekends, and I hated boarding school. My grandparents, my mom's whole family, are born and bred Irish, and we were in London, and in the 70s, that was not clever. things were blowing up, and so I wasn't very popular at school, and I had a hard time, and alcohol worked for me because I would sneak bottles back with me. I made friends with the biggest bully, and I never had another problem, you know, and I could see where alcohol worked, you know. And of course, when I drank, like a lot of people I've heard share, when I drink, I don't care anyway. You know, something happens when I drink because I think all of a sudden I'm 6 foot, 200 pounds. And I will face up to you as if I am, you know. The reality is I'm 5'3", and I've been 5'3" probably most of my life, you know. But when I drink, I don't feel it, you know. But when I was about 15, I decided I wanted to go to an American university. And I got totally obsessed with this book, and I don't share it a lot, but I was thinking about it the other day. I got totally obsessed with this book called The Preppy Handbook. Now, in London, preppy was really, like, almost exotic. You know, they had this whole handbook on how to be preppy and what schools to go to be preppy. And I got totally obsessed with this, as only a true alcoholic can. And I decided I was going to go to the preppiest university in America. But to do that, I needed something called an SAT, and I didn't know what that was. So I begged my parents to let me move in with them in Papillion, Nebraska, so I could go to an American high school to get into an American university. I had it all planned out. You know, I'm a thinker, right? So they let me, and you know, I got to this American high school where they were drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon, and I'm already a whiskey girl, you know. I was popular immediately because I drank a lot of people under the table and took pride in it, you know. I am and have been probably from the gate a blackout drinker. You know, I used to call it losing time. I'd lose a weekend, I might lose a day, I might lose a few hours, I didn't care. It was just always losing time. And I had assumed that when I had lost time, that I had passed out quietly somewhere, you know. I found out later that's not true, but you know, I don't remember much about high school, and I did go back to my 20-year high school reunion a few years ago. And, you know, it's funny because my perception of me in high school was very different from their perception of me in high school. They actually liked me. I really, you know, I get things on Facebook where they, you know, they're from high school. I think, I didn't like you then. Why would I like you now? You know, baffling. But the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes me lovely around page 33 because it basically says it doesn't matter how much you drink or how often you drink, it's what happens when you drink, and that many who are merely potential alcoholics often become the real thing in a relatively short amount of time, particularly true of women. And I am one of those women. You know, by 16, I had an ulcer. By 17, I got done for drunk driving. At 18, I had a heart attack, and 6 months later, I was in my first mental hospital. And that's really when alcohol was working, you know. It truly went all downhill after that, you know. Over the next 3 years, I was in and out of 5 mental hospitals, and the longest I was ever out of a mental hospital was for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, I was in my own flat. I had the curtains drawn, the answering machine on, a fridge full of Asti Spumante, vodka, and Michelob Light, you know, because I was always watching calories, too. But in those 2 weeks, I did not speak or see anyone, and then I was happy. You know, I have a clear memory of standing in the shower, drinking a cold McLight, not knowing if it was day or night, not caring, and thinking it just doesn't get any better than this, you know. But what happened was I got a knock on the door one day, and it was my mom, my shrink, two policemen, and two nurses, and they shot me in the arse with something and put me in a jacket with really long arms. And I came to at the Institute for the Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And I felt like I was on candid camera. I'd been punked or something, you know. I found out I'd been committed for a minimum of a year for being a danger to myself and others. And I was thinking, I hadn't seen anybody for 2 weeks. Who could the others be? And it really bothered me, you know. And anybody who's been in a place like that knows the people in those places are crazy, right? Now, I knew there was something wrong with me. I've always known there was something just a little off, right? I don't think I've ever been a full ticket. I don't think I'm ever going to be a full ticket. And quite honestly, I do not believe there is a program in a world that can make me a full ticket. What I do know is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools to allow me to act as if I'm a full ticket. And I've been running with that for a while now, you know. But at the time, I knew there was something wrong, and I knew they didn't know what it was. And I had this roommate, and my roommate, it was really obvious what was wrong with her, right? I mean, she had rage attacks. One minute she'd be fine, and she'd snap. And she'd start punching out windows and going for nurses, and it'd be chaos. And I'd be sitting on the bed reading, you know, nothing going on here. I'm good, you know. And they did this thing called wet packing, and all these nurses would come in, they would tackle her to the floor, wrap her in cold, wet sheets, and toddle her away. And she'd be away for a long time. Now, she had something I didn't have, and that was friends locally. And her friends used to smuggle money in for her all the time. So when she got toddled away, I'd start thinking, right? Because I am a thinker. I started thinking, what a waste it is to leave all that money just sitting around, you know. So I used to go AWOL on her dime. And the first time I went AWOL, I had $50 on me, and I ended up in downtown Hartford, and I had no clue what I was going to do. But this little fellow wandered up to me, and he said, "Psst, do you want to buy a ticket to Prince?" Now, I didn't know who Prince was. I am truly an AC/DC Black Sabbath kind of girl. But I'm thinking a dark auditorium, this may work, right? So I get these tickets, I'm sitting in the nosebleed seats, I smuggled in a couple of bottles of vodka, and while he did his little raspberry beret thing, I got absolutely legless. And after the concert, I was wandering around Hartford, and I ended up in this park, and there was a little group of fellas, winos, really, passing a bottle, and I sat down with them. And they were good as gold. They let me drink with them, and they never said a word. They kept looking at me like stupid or crazy. But they were really good. And as dawn came, the white van with the blue letters pulled up, Institute for the Living. And I stood up and said, "I got to go. My ride's here." It's a true story. And you know, these fellas just looked at each other like, yep, crazy, right? And of course, I'd get back and I'd have to build up my little trust points, and anybody who's been institutionalized knows about that. And you know, I just didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And when my year was coming up, I had to go before a board of psychiatrists. And my psychiatrist stood up and said, "Hilda will never live in normal society. She is completely incapable." And his recommendation was that I did a minimum of another year. And it took me about 2.5 months to convince the board to let me out. So I did 14 and a half months total. And in hindsight, I think he may have had a point. Because I moved from Hartford to Hamden, which was just down the road, and I got a little job, and I met a fella. And this fella turned out to be a coke dealer. Now, I had never done coke. I had no idea that it would allow me to drink longer, which was exactly the attraction for me. Of course, all you nodding already knew that. I did not. So what happened was, though, in a relatively short amount of time, I've got a little job at $700 a week. I have a coke habit of $1,500 a week. And when you do the math, it wasn't coming out terribly well. And I was sitting on the counter in my kitchen one day, I was drinking McLeod at the time, and I looked out at my flat and realized I had sold everything, including my curtains, for Coke. And I thought, Hilda, if you're hanging out with people who will buy your curtains, we have a problem here. Do you know, I never did Coke again. And in fact, I'd be in parties and people around me would be doing Coke and my head would go, mm-mm-mm, remember the curtains. Now, far worse things happened to me drinking than ever happened to me with Coke. And never once did my head ever say, don't drink. What it might say is, stay away from the whiskey because it makes you mean. You know, don't drink the red wine because it makes you cry. You know, or my version of chapter 3, switching from scotch to brandy or scott to randy. But it never said, don't drink. And I think that's what makes me a real alcoholic, right? So I'm in Hamden, I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, I never should have left England. It was so much better there, you know. And I move back to England, and I wouldn't be in England very long, and I get done for drunk driving, drunk and disorderly, indecent exposure, and I think, you know, America was so much better. And that's really my drinking in a nutshell. It was always going to be better somewhere else, and everywhere I went, there I was. And I have a long list of arrests for indecent exposure, and I know I don't look the type today. Well, maybe a little. But something happens when you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, and I know I'm not alone in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've heard plenty of women share this. But as soon as you add alcohol to my type of alcoholic, for whatever reason, I have to show you my tits. Now, now, I know that that's part of my alcoholism, because I don't feel the need to show them to you now, right? So I'm back and forth and back and forth, and I was back in England this time and tending bar with my mate Andy. Andy and I have been great friends for a long time, and Andy's birthday was on New Year's Eve. So we started drinking on Christmas Eve, as you do, and I came to on the 3rd of January with the phone ringing, and when I answered it, it was Andy, and he asked me if I was ready to pick out rings, and I had no clue what he was talking about. And I said, I fumbled through it, and he said, no, Hilda, not this time. Now, he brought over a video, and I was on this video, and I look great. I am not slurring my words. I'm not walking funny. I have drink in hand the whole time. All our friends were there. My father was there. It's all the pubs we were in, and I'm watching the video, and Andy went down on one knee, and I thought, dear God, say no, because I just wasn't there. And it was the first time I realized that when I blacked out, you didn't know I didn't know I wasn't there, right? Because I didn't know. And I did what I did best, really. I went to the pub because I didn't know what else to do. And I found the guy in the pub that knows everything, right? He's the guy that knows everything about everything. When you ask him the time, he explains how the pendulum clock works, right? And I'm telling him what happened, and poor old me, and I don't know what to do. And he says to me, did you know that if you volunteer on a kibbutz in Israel, they give you 3 meals a day, they do your laundry, and you get 50 quid a month? And I thought, result? 3 days later, I'm in Golders Green, I got a visa, I'm going to Israel. And I'm a good Irish Catholic girl, this all made sense to me. I went for 3 months, I stayed 9, and I came out of a blackout in a Tel Aviv jail charged with drunk driving. And I didn't remember renting the car. And I can tell you that really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I got out on bail, and I ended up jumping bail, and I went to Egypt, and I ended up with the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time, and really horrible things happen to young, vulnerable women who drink like I do in places like that. And I ended up getting dumped just near the American embassy on the roundabout in Cairo, and a big American Marine took pity on me. It was Ramadan, and everything was shut, including the embassy, and him and his mates looked after me until it opened. And You know, I can tell you, I truly believe a non-alcoholic woman who had been through what I had been through would probably never drink again. But I'm a goalpost drinker. I'm one of those drinkers that says, if it gets bad, I move the goalpost back just a little bit. And I think if it gets worse, I move the goalpost back just a little bit more. The reality was I wasn't 20 minutes in the air. I thought, hell, they could have killed me. I was drunk when I landed. And I had no clue that it was alcoholism. I didn't know what was happening. And the whole 80s for me are a bit like the Talking Head song, Once in a Lifetime, when he goes, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here? It's like one big long blackout with little bits of reality tossed in. And coming towards the end of the 80s, I found out I was in a relationship that apparently I had been in for quite a while. And my partner was commenting on my drinking, which I just thought was rude. And I'll tell you exactly what that was, that whole, I have a clear memory of one day I was standing in the kitchen and over my partner's shoulder I could see them repossessing the car. And without missing a beat, I looked at my partner and said, you know, babe, I think I'll walk to work today. That's how I handled everything, you know, just. So coming to the end of the 80s, I really didn't know what to do, so I moved. I went to Nebraska and moved in with me mom, and I wasn't with me mom very long, and she started commenting on my drinking, and I was really lost, and I thought about my uncle. My uncle had tried to 12-step me in a pub in St. Albans when I was 18. He was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was on fire. And I can remember him saying, you know, Hilda, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need never drink again. I was 18. I thought, why the hell wouldn't I want to drink? But he could see where I was going. And fast forward, it's all gone horribly wrong. And I thought about him. And he was still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he was what I thought a real alcoholic was, right? My uncle went to prison. I only ever went to jail, you know? My uncle went to detox centers. I only ever went to mental hospitals. So in my mind, he was what a real alcoholic was, and yet he was still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was really attractive to me. So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on New Year's Eve, 1989. I picked New Year's Eve because I thought no real alcoholic would quit drinking on New Year's Eve. I know today that only alcoholics pick a day, right? Ask any Al-Anon in here, they've never picked a day to stop drinking, you know. And so I went on New Year's Eve 1989, and I went into this room in Papillion, Nebraska. It was really small, it was a super small meeting, and they were talking about, he's the father, we're the children, and I thought I was screwed. Because I've always been a seeker, right? Israel, please. I knew that couldn't be the answer, and I couldn't hear anything else in the meeting. So I started taking everybody's inventory by their shoes, because I can't look at you either. And the fella next to me had on the biggest pair of cowboy boots I'd ever seen. And I'm thinking, I wonder if his IQ is any bigger than his boot size. I mean, I'm tearing these people to shreds. And after the meeting, I made a beeline for my car, and this big, dumb cowboy followed me out. And he came up to me and he said, have you got a big book? I said, of course I have a big book. Doesn't everybody have a big book? Now, I wouldn't have known a big book if you'd beat me with it. But I couldn't tell him that, you know. Without missing a beat, he went to his truck, and he gave me his big book. And I was stunned because nobody had ever seen through me like that. And I was speechless, actually. I went to get in my car, and this little old woman ran up to me and said, did you know if you go to a lot of meetings and you don't drink in between, you can't get drunk? Thank you. I got in my car, I thought, these people are freaks. But something happened as I drove away. That little old woman's voice resonated in my head, and I thought, hang on a minute, she may have a point here. If I go to a lot of these meetings and I don't drink in between, I may stay out of trouble. That's what was attractive to me, and that's exactly what I did. So for 3 years, I went to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came late, I left early. I took your inventory. I did what was asked of me, sort of, if I felt like it, you know. I really did not think that I was as bad as you were, you know. You seemed to need steps and sponsors, and you know. And finally, I gave in because people were giving me such a hard time about not having a sponsor, right? You know what they're like. So I found the oldest, frailest woman I could find. And I figured she wouldn't give me a hard time. Yeah, I was wrong. She really tried. She really did. When I was about 3 years sober, she got really, really ill, and she was in hospital. And I went to see her one day, and she said, "Just remember, Hilda, Alcoholics Anonymous will be here for you when you come back." And I hadn't drank yet. And I had no clue what she was talking about, but she knew exactly what was going on. And of course, when she passed away, I pulled away. I went from 7 meetings a week to 5 to 4, 3 a week, 2 a week, 2 a month, because now I'm very busy. And I'm not going to Wednesday night because I can't stand the secretary. And I'm not going to Friday night because the same guy shares the same shite every week. You know, and now I'm taking AA's inventory, you know. And I'm in Florida, and I'm on my way to my dream job in Germany, the job I had always wanted. I worked so hard to get this job. And I'm walking on the beach with my my partner, and my partner turned to me and said, "You know what, Hilda, not only do I not like you..."
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
"I don't love you drunk or sober." And I thought, "Are you kidding? 3.5 years I haven't had a drink for you," which was my other problem. Arrogance and ignorance is what I suffered from, and I had no clue. I had no clue. I could not hear you. So I put my now ex on a plane, and I'm in the airport. I walked in the bar. I started with double Jack, because that's how I drink. I started drinking on the Thursday, arrived in Germany on the Sunday, started my new job on the Monday, got done for drunk driving on the Friday, and woke up in a wet bed next to my new boss on Saturday morning. Glamour drinking, right? I'm not kidding when I say I'm a lying bedwetting whore. I drank like that for 9 months. And, you know, I have one moment in that 9 months where I came out of a blackout, and I was in a hotel room, and the hotel room was wrecked. There had obviously been something going on. And I had no clue where I was. The last thing I remembered was sitting in my living room saying, "Tonight, Hilda, we're watching a movie." What happened was, I was living in Germany. I came to in this hotel room, and when I went to the balcony, I saw the Eiffel Tower. And I thought, "I wonder where the car is." Right? It's Paris. Where would you put a car, you know? And the morning after what I hope is my last night before, I woke up in my own bed, which had become a bonus. I was still dressed from work, which was really normal. The bed was wet, and I went into the loo, and as I was washing my face, there was blood everywhere. I had a great gash in my hose, gash on my face. I had no clue what had happened. You know, I had that moment. I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You think, "God, you're so dramatic." That morning, I knew who they were, and my heart broke. Not because I can't drink. I drink with the best of them. But that morning I realized I had become unpredictable to me. I did not care when I was unpredictable to you. But that morning I realized I'd become unpredictable to me. And I didn't know what else to do but call English-speaking AA. And I talked to a guy called Steve Baker, who lets me break his anonymity. And I told him my sad old story. Poor old me, been to AA, screwed it up, whine, whine, whine. He said something to me I truly believe saved my life. He said, "You know, Hilda, the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is drink. And that's why in Alcoholics Anonymous we don't shoot our wounded." And I believed him. It was the only reason why I went to a meeting that night, was because I thought he understood. So I drove over to this meeting in Hunsbrück, Holland. And as I'm going over, I'm thinking about the meetings in Florida and California, you know, big meetings where I could come in late, leave early, and get a little bit of time and then tell you what happened. That was my plan. I walked into this meeting in Hunsbrück Hall, and there were 7 people in the room for an hour and a half. And they're all, you know, shiny and new, and I'm like a vision for you. And it was not pretty, you know. And they weren't letting me pass, so I ended up sharing with all of them my sad old story. And at the end of the meeting, they were looking for somebody to make the tea and coffee, and I thought, God, I hope they find someone. You know, that's an important commitment. And this voice from across the room went, Hilda will do it. And I thought, Hilda who? This meeting was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and this was Tuesday night. And I said to the woman, hang on a minute, I didn't know if I'm going to be sober on Thursday. That seemed like a long time to me. She said, if you want to stay sober, you'll make the tea and coffee. And I was like, who is this psycho bitch, and why is she tormenting me, you know? But my mouth just went, oh, okay. Because I was tired. You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really hope you're tired. I hope you're willing to do anything. Because I would have done anything this woman suggested, and I tried. Because I just didn't know what else to do. You know, I've shared before, she ended up being my sponsor. I was reading something in the literature one night. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was prompted me to call her promptly. And I called her in the middle of the night, and she answered, and I said, hey, Sandy, I think I need a sponsor, and I wondered if you'd sponsor me. And she said, I have been, but thanks for making it official. That's the kind of sponsor Sandy was. And I've shared this before, but she truly was the service sponsor from hell. You know, she was on every committee and all these convention committees, and she was regional chair, and, you know, and she had me drive her everywhere, right? You know, Europe's not a big place. It's pretty easy to drive around, but she'd always say, pick me up at 8 on Saturday, Hilda, we're going to the region meeting, or pick me up at, you know, 6 o'clock tomorrow night, we're going to the convention meeting, whatever, fine. So I kept picking her up and picking her up and picking her up, and I was about 7 months sober, and she pulled up in front of the meeting. I looked at her and I said, you can drive? I asked her years later, I said, what was that about? She said, I had to keep you busy, Hilda. I didn't know what else to do with you, you know. And it's true, you know. Service is my core, and it saved my life. I have to say, when all else fails, I throw myself into service. And it's funny because this meeting in Holmesbrook, Holland, was Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So my sponsor said, you know, you really need to try to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, you see where we are, Holmesbrook, Holland, right? It's nowhere, hang a left. She said, well, you know, there's a meeting in Dusseldorf Friday night and Kaiserslautern on Wednesday and Dahan on Monday. I was like, I'm not driving all over God's acre for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not happening. She goes, huh, how far did you drive for a drink? Which is so unfair, right? Because I am that drunk at 2 a.m. driving around for anything open, right? So I started tormenting my home group because when I was drinking, if I got lost, I would find the nearest B&B, grab a couple of bottles, and call it a day. I did it on the way to job interviews, weddings. If I got lost, all bets were off, you know. So Thursday night, I'd say, I'm going to Dusseldorf tomorrow night. Does anybody want to go? The guy I hated the most, hated, always went, I'll go with you, Hilda. It's like anybody but you, right? But Mike would show up every Friday. We would drive an hour and a half to Dusseldorf for an hour and a half's meeting, for an hour's coffee afterwards, and an hour and a half's drive home. And I wanted to kill him the entire time, right? I've left skid marks on the Autobahn where I pulled over for him to get out. And he had 8 years of sobriety, and he would just laugh. We're going to be late if you don't get going. I learned principles before personalities. You have to when you hate your home group, right? And but I'm grateful for that today, you know, because for me, it's never too early, it's never too far, it's never too late, you know. One of my favorite speakers talks about when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, be ready to be divinely inconvenienced, right? And that has been my experience, and today I love it. You know, it really is never too far, never too early, never too late. And Sandy was a great sponsor for me. She gave me a great foundation. I was sitting in her kitchen one day, and she was dragging me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because I argued and debated everything. I am that pain in the arse. And I said to her one day, you know, what difference does it make, Sandy? I always drink. I always drink. I'm going to drink. And she said, well, if it doesn't make any difference, don't drink tonight. And if you truly take on step 6 and 7, you never have to drink again, because that's where you get to change. And she gave me hope. She told me truly that, she actually promised me, that if I took on 6 and 7 and truly put it into my life, I could no longer use the excuse of I've always been and I'm always going to be, because that's where it gets to change. And I really love her for that. You know, she drank at 21 years of sobriety, 22. And, you know, I know today, I heard somebody say it once and I thought it was really kind of kitschy, but they said, be nice to the newcomer, they may be your sponsor one day. And, you know, that's an example of that. You know, I would never take away the foundation she gave me. I would not be the woman I am today without her help. But she stopped doing what we do. She stopped doing what she taught me. And that's what happens. I was about, 14 months sober and moved to London. And I did about 8 years in London AA. And you know, my sobriety hasn't been textbook sobriety. I was about 2 years sober and I got a brilliant idea to change my career. I was going to go into a helping profession. I was going to help people. At 2 years sober, it never dawned on me that I just don't like people enough to want to do that. But, you know, I went on the dole and I started trying to get into university and have had money been poor in sobriety, and that was one of the poorest times I had and one of the best times in my sobriety. You know, I took panels into the women's prison and because I had the time. I did voluntary work, and you know, I really wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a thing. You know, I was about 4 years sober, and I got into university, so I got a motorcycle. And 4.5 years sober, I had a bike accident, so I got a bigger bike, and a couple of tattoos. And you know, 5 years sober, I started my second year at university, and nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous seemed surprised. And I thought it was because they believed in me. I found out later it's because they believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And then I was about 6.5 years sober, and everything was tootling along quite nicely, and I got a phone call. I was on my way to the Southern National Convention in England, and my mom had called for me to come back to California. She'd been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she wanted me to come back to Pasadena when she had her operations that were coming up in a couple of months, and I said I would. And it may not seem like a big deal to you, but it was massive to me because nobody in my family ever gave me bad news. You know, whenever anything bad happened, I would go on a bender, so now I'm missing and there's bad news, you know, so they just stopped telling me. And yet, here my mom was asking me to come back, and I went on to this convention, and I was standing in line for registration, and this fellow pulled me aside, and he said, would you share at the midnight meeting? And I said, you know, I'm really not up for it. And he said, actually, you look like you need to share. And what I didn't realize was that my outsides were starting to match my insides, and he'd known me a long time, and he said, come on, Hilda, there'll be nobody there. Right, the old timers meeting is going on at the same time. It'll be fine. And I said, fine, whatever, I'll be there. And I went to talk at this midnight meeting, and there was 200 people in the room, and you know, I cried for the very first time ever in Alcoholics Anonymous when I shared about my mom. I had never cried in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, when you cried, I used to tap your knee. You know, sorry. I had no frame of reference. I had nothing. But I cried when I shared about my mom, and something happened that night. A guy I barely knew stood up in the back of the room and offered me a flight to Los Angeles if I couldn't afford it. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous touched me that night. It was the first time I realized I was part of something bigger than a meeting, that I was part of a fellowship and that I was in the middle of the bed. And, you know, when the time came, I did come out to California for my mom. And, you know, I'd spent my entire sobriety asking my sponsor, how do I make amends to my mom? Right? I'm an only child. I tore her heart out. I called her collect from foreign jails when she could do nothing. You know, my sponsor always shares, if you're sitting here with us tonight, there are 10 people sleeping better tonight. 10 people digesting their dinner better because you're here safe with us. My mother is one of the 10, you know. And my sponsor kept saying, it's God's time, not yours, and when the time is right, you'll know. And I was like, oh. So I came out when she had the operation, and I made sure I was there when she woke up, and I was there when she went to sleep. And, you know, the old 202 Club in Pasadena used to be right across the street from Huntington Hospital, and I'd dash across to meetings when she was sleeping and get back. And, you know, I did everything I could. And oddly enough, you know, they say, is it odd or is it God? But oddly enough, because of what I had been doing at university, I got to take her home early and nurse her at home. And I was changing her tubes one day, and my mom turned to me and said, you know, Hilda, I don't know how I'll ever repay you. I said, you don't get it. 6.5 years I have waited for this moment when I get to be the daughter you deserved instead of the one you had, you know. And I love that thing, life is not measured by the number of breaths you take, but by the moments that take your breath away. Because that's been my sobriety, those moments, not the years. And my mom and I have a great relationship today, and she is a member of Al-Anon, and I am grateful to the fellowship of Al-Anon, because we wouldn't have a relationship without that, you know. My mom really needed it. but, you know, when I was 8 years sober, I moved out to Southern California, and my partner and I came out on a 5-year plan. We stayed 7, as you do, and Southern California changed my entire sobriety. You know, I absolutely love it. The sponsor I got when I got out here, a couple of years after we got out here, reminded me of what my primary purpose is, to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. I had lost that somewhere along the way. And she got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm part of an active home group, and I love it because that's what I need. Even today, over 20 years sobriety, you still have to keep me busy, right? I'm just one of those. I'm one of the summers, you know, summer cigarette nutters, right? I'm a summer girl, you know. A few years ago, we had to go back to Ireland. My other half had trouble with visas, and we went back to Ireland for a year. And, you know, I'm well-trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I phone my sponsor every day, and I phoned her every day from Ireland. And I had a terrible time in Ireland. I just couldn't get on there. And finally, one day, I called Sharon and said I didn't know what to do. And she's up to date with me because I talked to her a lot. And she said, it's time you got on a plane. And I actually said, get on an effing plane. But I hung up the phone, and my partner said, what did Sharon say? And I said, she told me to get on an effing plane. And my partner, who has 3 months longer sober than I do, and will let you know so, said, do you need a ride to the airport? Right, because that's Alcoholics Anonymous. We knew it would work out. And I came back to LA. I was 15.5 years sober, jobless, penniless, sleeping on my mom's floor. Not where I wanted to be at 15.5 years sober, you know. And I didn't know what else to do, so I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what I do. I got busy. You know, I started sponsoring people again. I went back to the yard, went to a lot of meetings, and you know, things worked out. My partner got back into the States and got a better job. I got a job and then got a better job. And you know, life started going on. And, you know, when I was on my mom's floor, I was really feeling bad about it. And Sharon reminded me that, you know, my mom and I were having some quality time together. And it never dawned on me that maybe my mom needed that to feel like a mom, you know. So in 2012, when my company that I was working for was going under, I called my mom. And I said, you know, my company is going under. I'm going to be out of work. And my mom said, you can come live with me. It took her 24 hours to realize I'd given her bad news. You know, she phoned me the next day. Oh, Hilda, I'm really sorry about your job. You know? Too late, you know. But that's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And in April of 2012, I was up for two jobs at the same time. And I always share this because it's amazing to me. I was up for two jobs at the same time. One was with unmanned drones for the military, and the other was with the Spirit of Giving. Unmanned drones, Spirit of Giving. Now, if you had more than a 10-minute conversation with me, you know I'm an unmanned drones for the military kind of girl, right? My sponsor, who's an ex-bong wine drinking hippie, said the Spirit of Giving would be good for you. So I was being a smartass, and I said, let's leave it to God, right? So whoever offers me the job first, I will take. And of course, my sponsor thought that was a great idea. And so I've been working for the spirit of giving for for over 2 years now. You know, we have slides from the second floor to the first. Barefoot Fridays, yeah. I'm still getting used to it. But it's a great job, and I'm really good at it. And last year, I got to go on a giving trip to a third world country to put shoes on kids' feet. And I am not that gal. I am not that gal. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not qualify for the third tradition. You know, I didn't come to stop drinking. I came to stay out of wet beds with ugly people. You know, that's the truth, you know. And the only reason that I have the life I have today is because I am the product of strong sponsorship, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it is in the big book, and meetings like this with people like you. I came to you a lying bedwetting whore, and somewhere along the way you have turned me into a good friend, a loving and monogamous wife, and a true daughter to my mother, and for that I thank you.
Let's give Hilda another big round of applause.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.